interlopers who didn't belong to a tribe by the fact that it couldn't pronounce the sound sh. So it's to do with getting entrance into some kind of society, becoming part of something or not becoming part of something. It's only 12 lines. Just like being a double agent. One didn't know the name of Tarzan's monkey. Another couldn't strip the cellophane from a GI's pack of cigarettes. By such minutiae were the infiltrators detected. By the second week of battle, we'd become obsessed with trivia. At a sentry point, at midnight, in the rain, an ignorance of baseball could be lethal. The morning of the first snowfall, I was shaving, staring into a mirror, nailed to a tree, intoning the Christian names of the Andrews sisters, Maxine, Laverne, Patty. I'm not going to sit down and talk with Maddie about many, many things. I should perhaps just say that I knew Michael somewhat, a little. Michael's a little bit younger than I am, by about 5 or 6 years. And I think I've known Michael since about the 1980s. But it's a lovely occasion to say, well, that's a very interesting poem about who are you? Are you an infiltrator? What kind of creature are you? And I think that's a sort of issue which comes up in Michael's poems time and again. And we'll talk about it a wee bit, about the way that, for example, the central figure, the I figure in poems is not necessarily, in fact, probably rather rarely, to be identified with the poet. Did Michael have many voices or many identities, do you think, Maddie?
He predated Facebook, but no doubt were he on Facebook, he'd have several different aliases on the go, I think. He liked to be able to say things, but he didn't like sticking his head above the parapet, so he would have little voices. He sometimes submitted poems under other names, just to see whether he could get them by. Yes, I think he was... I think he had a very strong sense of identity, but he kept it quite well hidden.
But it was quite complicated in a way, because he was partly Irish. Mm. He was brought up in America. Like a working-class family, or as you were saying to me before, a non-working working-class family, in the Bronx, which is quite a tough area. Then he comes to England and stays here. So in a way, that's already three different sort of personae to be coping with.
Exactly. And also moving out of his class in a way through education. I mean, his uncle in England drove a bread truck, and then Michael was doing a PhD. You know, he'd already sort of left behind his own people, so I think he felt quite separated from a lot of things. And he never quite fully became Irish in the way that you could, perhaps living in England, be considered Irish because of the American connection.
It's interesting because Shibboleth is full of really American connection. It's very much an American thing.
It's the Battle of the Bulge, apparently.
That's right. I wonder how many of you did know the names of the Andrews sisters. do you at least know who the Andrews sisters were? because Michael's poems are also so full of reference to all kinds of things. This is very much to kind of popular culture, but there's, you know, a great many other things.
Yes. I mean, he was very erudite. He spent his childhood hiding in the library from the local bullies and read everything and remembered everything he read. He didn't remember that he was supposed to pick up his son from school at given time or anything practical and useful, but he had a phenomenal memory for culture and information.
It's one of the lovely things that I think, one of the many things I admired, still admire, about Michael's poetry. It's the way in which there's this great layer of learning, which you discover even more as you go in, but it's not off-putting, it's not exclusive, it's not kind of snobbish, it's not like being scholarly and being sort of flashy for its own sake. He's not going to be writing a wasteland, he's going to be doing, working these things into the poems, like kind of grace.
So you spot them if you know them, but you don't need to know them in order to understand their meaning. I think that's very important.
Yeah, absolutely that. Were you going to read a bit from your own book? Because I mean, Maddie's in The Great Below, that's an account. Well, you can talk about it and tell people what it is.
I'll stand at the lectern to read it. This book is, it's about Michael to some degree, but it's really about me and living with Michael and living with his dying. So I'm going to start just with, this, I suppose you could call it a rather brutal entry, which is when he did die, and it drops you in right in the middle of the story, so I apologise for anyone who's not prepared for that. But and then I'll read a little bit about how we met in the beginning of our love affair of 21 years. So. My husband, the poet Michael Donaghy, died on Thursday, 16th of September, 2004, having suffered a brain hemorrhage the previous weekend. He was 50 and I was 4 years younger. It was one of those bright, crisp autumn days in a whole week of beautiful days. I stood at his feet and held on to his dear, familiar toes as if still trying to ground him while the nurse removed the breathing tube. In the process, she accidentally scratched his throat, which made him utter a choking cough. It was the first time since he became unconscious on Sunday that I'd heard the sound of his voice, and the last time I ever would. "Sorry, Michael, so sorry," she said. For a moment, it wasn't clear to me what had happened. I asked, "Has he gone?" And she said, "Yes." He quickly began to turn blue, as I'd been warned. I laid my head on his chest where I could hear his heart still beating strongly. It continued to do so for what seemed ages, and I thought how much Michael had worried about his heart, yet here it was, almost outliving him with its sturdy rhythm. "Silly bugger," I told him quietly. But then the sound came to an end and he was still. His skin colour began to return to pink. My sister was weeping quietly, but I felt calm, almost euphoric. We'd been given a quiet, curtained-off space in an empty ward for the end game. The ward sister, whose shift had officially ended at lunchtime, had stayed on with us into the evening to be with us through the death, like a midwife for the end of life. In the old days, it was the same women who guided people into life and out of it, assisting at births and laying out bodies for burial. But this, on a busy neurosurgery ward where many patients do not survive, was the most generous of acts. We felt held, contained, but never hurried. In a version of an age-old ritual, I'd helped to wash Michael's body in preparation. They let me cut his toenails, and I noticed that, ironically, the terrible athlete's foot, which had recently been giving him such trouble, had completely cleared up. The nurse gave him a shave, a job she said she liked doing, but nothing could be done about his hair, which was matted with blood from the operation that had cut open his skull and was now stiff with sweat. Finally, we dressed him in a fresh hospital gown printed in yellow and red with the words, "For hospital use only," which reminded me of a hamburger wrapping. I would have liked to have candles or anointing oils, but health and safety forbade them. So instead, we had a little interlude of poetry and song to send him on his way. I recited The Present, one of his poems, from memory, getting the last line slightly wrong. Then I sang a song that I used to sing to him when we were young and first in love, "To Althea from Prison," with words by, and in here I've written Sir Walter Raleigh, but it's not Sir Walter Raleigh, it's Sir Richard Lovelace, I have found out, a Tudor poet, set to an Irish melody, a song about how the spirit can be free, even when the body is in chains. For good measure, I ended with a funny song Michael had made up for our 8-year-old son, Rory, which begins, "You've got to keep a chicken on your head." Outside, the light was fading, and inside, the ward lights were dimmed, so the room had a grey peacefulness about it as we said goodbye. I thought a lot about those final moments, how we made the choice which modern medicine has created for us, whether to continue to keep someone artificially alive or let them go. In effect, we finished him off like a wounded animal. What an awesome and awful task to have to perform as a doctor or nurse, no matter how used to death you've become. The final checks, pulse, temperature, a torch flashed in the eyes to see if the pupils are at all reactive. Still no contraction, clearly brain dead. Then we unplug him. At the very moment of his dying, a close friend of his called the hospital. She'd heard him call out her name quite loudly inside her head. Another friend reported feeling a sudden sense of peace, the fretful anxiety of the past few days lifting like a cloud. One of our son's teachers later told me she'd felt suddenly breathless at that particular moment and had a sense it might be all over. Several of Michael's friends told me later of dreams they'd had that night, one dream that she and he were lying flat on the ground in New York, making snow angels by flapping their wings to make the imprint of wings. Sorry, their arms. Flapping their arms to make the imprint of wings. He told her, "I used to worry a lot about this, but it's really fine." Afterwards, he lay on the bed, seeming no more dead or alive, really, than he had been moments before, than he had been for 4 days. I wondered how I would possibly be able to leave, to take the last sight of this man I'd loved for 21 years, who had been my soulmate, best friend, co-parent, latterly husband, and also my burden. But as I sat on, my thoughts turned to Rory, who was with a close friend, and it was like hearing a call from life to come, pay attention, let the dead bury their dead. I paused at the curtain, looked back once, left. So I guess what I wanted to do with writing this book, I really wanted to talk about grief, because when I was bereaved, I couldn't find much to reflect my experience back to me. There are more personal experience books now available, but at the time there was nothing really about losing a spouse in midlife or much about bereavement anyway, and particularly not about the fact that bereavement isn't over in 3 weeks, which people in our society seem to think, you know, have a funeral, get back to normal. But of course it's a very, very long and painful process, and you can only take it in the steps that you can take it in. And it's now 11 years since Michael died. I would say I'm still mourning him, of course, and I still miss him. But I'm unable to carry on living. You know. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about how we've heard the end of the story. Let's tell you about how we met. I met Mike. I've called the sections about that Our Life Stories, which those of you who know his poems is the title of one of his poems. I'm trying to do what Michael did, allude to little things that people will know if they know it. I met Michael on a street corner in Chicago when I was 25. He was 4 years older and was still officially in graduate school there, although by then he'd more or less deserted his PhD in favour of playing music. I'd come to Chicago in pursuit of another man, a neuroscientist, whom I met on a backpacking trip around America. I'd even moved in with him, but the relationship was doomed. We were simply too different. It was the first time I'd ever allowed myself to fall in love, and when it ended, I was in pieces. But a door had been opened in my heart. I see now the result of that first love affair was to put me in position, both geographically and emotionally, to meet Michael. The day we met, he was playing the tin whistle in his Irish band, Saura Music. It means summer in Irish. Nobody can pronounce it, even in America, at a street fair. And I was working one of several cash-in-hand jobs I'd picked up, distributing leaflets for a local shop. I positioned myself at the edge of the audience and took advantage of the crowd to give out my leaflets. I liked Irish music and had gone out with a traditional flute player when I was living in France. Michael had thick, curly hair, incredibly long eyelashes, and an expression of rapturous absorption in the music. I mean, you know, he was a very beautiful man. But my first impression was he looked like trouble. My kind of trouble, though, with his slightly ethereal beauty and air of romance. I didn't yet know that he wrote poetry, but at the age of 16, I told my mother I would marry a poet and live in a garret. I knew my own romantic nature. I hung around after the performance and introduced myself to the band members. I just cut my own hair rather badly, and Michael said later that I reminded him of a lost baby bird. He recognised my name and asked if I was on the band's mailing list. It turned out we had both read articles the other had written for the University Arts Journal. Mine was a review of a book called On the Problem of Men. His, a rather sentimental piece about a trip to Belfast. We found that we lived just round the corner from each other. But it took some pursuit on my part to bring us together. I tracked him down at another gig the following weekend, but he had to dash off to work afterwards. He worked most nights as a doorman in a Northside apartment building, coming home on public transport at a dangerous hour of the morning. He liked the peacefulness of the job, but not the necessary subservience. I made discreet inquiries of his housemates and turned up at his house for dinner on his evening off when it was his turn to cook. Later, he walked me home. He was always so warm and friendly in his dealings with everyone that it was hard to know whether his feelings went beyond geniality. One friend had warned me that he was friends with lots of women, but she didn't know whether he had girlfriends. But then he asked to come in. We kissed in the glow of a blue light bulb in my living room, and thus began our history together. Okay.
A couple of things in that passage, the first passage, and also a bit in the second. In fact, one is, I'll tell you how I knew that Michael had died, because one of my mature MA students came in up to Norwich. She was coming up from London and said, Michael's died. I said, I didn't know which Michael. I knew a number of Michaels, and Michael was the least person I expected to die. He was just 50. He was born 6 years after me, so he was younger. He was a young person, so it was very, very sudden. And of course, this student, the MA student, his name was Roger, he'd been taught by Michael. So Michael had a life as a teacher, and I knew that he was a very, very much loved and admired teacher. And then you heard about him playing a flute. And, of course, he was also a musician. He played in a band called the Slip Gigolos, which played Irish music. And he often, when he was reading, he had his flute with him. He didn't have to read from books. You can tell me more about that. And he could recite his poems. And those who didn't know about, he could learn. So when I saw him reading, it would be that rather marvelous experience, which I can't provide, which is of simply knowing your poems and speaking them off, so having this very direct contact with the audience. So there were these two gifts, and at the beginning we were talking in Shibboleth about the different sort of aliases of Michael. So here we've got two things. We've got him as a teacher, which I think is probably a later thing, and then we've got the music. Do you want to talk about the Perhaps talk about the music a bit, if you would.
Yes. Well, that was how we met. You know, it was the Irish music. And he played the tin whistle, he played the flute, the wooden flute, the baran. He was very good at the drum, played completely by ear. He'd always rejected Irish music up to that point because it seemed like a sentimental thing that the old people did. But then there was a resurgence in the 70s and 80s of Irish bands and folk in general, which he got very keen on, you know. Bought every single record that came out for about 15 years. So, I feel that he was, I think I said this to you, I think music was the most central thing to him, probably even more than poetry in some weird way, because he always had music running through his head. He was very much an innate musician, I think.
But part of his great grace, I think, grace is the word I think of when I think of Michael's poetry. And we'll talk about what are the relationships of that grace to other poetry, just a little bit further along the line. But that musicality was very important to him in poetry, wasn't
yes.
it?
So yes. I had the experience of proofreading one of his books, and I was proofreading without thinking of the sense, if you see what I mean, just the words. And it was so musical. It was like a very lulling experience to read just the words. So for him, poetry had to contain music. I mean, probably the worst thing he could say about another poet was that they had a tin ear. And he wasn't unkind about people at all. He would always try and find. But if he couldn't hear the music, then it wasn't his thing, really. But when he came to London, he came over to London in 1985. So we'd been carrying out this long-distance relationship between America and London. Long, expensive phone calls with awkward silences and flights back and forth. And he came to London. We lived in North London at the time, and we could walk to an Irish session every day of the week. So it was the perfect place, really, for him, because lots of musicians then lived around us.
He was a very warm character. That's my first impression of Michael when I met him at some other house at some party or other. He could come and join us. Was before Michael actually published his first book. So it's written about 19. When did the first book, Shibboleth, come out?
88.
88. So it's about 85, 86.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. And he's a very affable, very, very outgoing, very good with society. But the interesting thing is, you say something else which you set up in that first passage. He'd had a problem with athlete's foot. But How is Michael with illness?
He was ill. He was all ill. I mean, one of his ex-girlfriends said to me, the first thing he says every morning is, ouch, and it was quite true.
Well, you have this idea something. That almost all poets are hypochondriacs.
I've known a lot of poets who are hypochondriacs. I think it might be something to do with the fact that their thoughts are always up here, so their body's having to keep saying, come on, pay attention, here I am.
You will know them by their imagined diseases.
Yeah. Or maybe they've just got vivid imaginations. I mean, that could be the thing. Yes, he did suffer a lot with his imaginary ill health and things that he had wrong with him, like he had an unsteady heart rhythm, which was not life-threatening, but felt quite unpleasant. And so I think my sympathy was slightly worn thin at various points.
How did he relate to... there were these three places, Ireland to him.
Yes.
His father was from Belfast, wasn't he?
His father was from Belfast, his mother was from Kerry. Okay. So almost chalk and cheese in terms of Irishness, but both Catholic families. So
there's Ireland and there's the Bronx.
The Bronx.
Which is kind of very much New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's England. How did these things live within him, do you think?
Well, his parents always considered Ireland home, as many immigrant families do. They live somewhere, but home is where they came from. So he was always brought up to think of Ireland as home, but he obviously really thought of himself as American. But in London, people didn't necessarily take him for an American because he had quite a soft accent, didn't have a Bronx accent, had a soft, could have been Irish sort of accent. And he didn't talk very loudly, which, excuse me if there's any Americans in the audience, but there is a tendency to
did he feel at home in London? Did he feel people's... I know Ireland was... What his parents, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was Ireland his own first inner home, or do you think he was happy in London?
Well, he went to Ireland as a child at age four. They spent a year there. His father thought he was going to get a job, and they'd gone back home. And then it didn't materialise, and they had to really go back with a tail between their legs to the Bronx, where I don't think either of them really wanted to be. So he had very, very strong, vivid memories of Ireland as a child, smells and memories and stories about some boys who were beating a donkey, and he went up to them and said, "It's the animal that brought our Lord into Jerusalem. You mustn't beat it." So,
there's another question, which is a religion question, because Michael does allude to religion quite often in the poems, to Catholicism primarily. Yes. What was his feelings?
I would have said he was completely atheist, but then actually after he died and I was reading his work, I thought, oh, there's where it is. There's the spirituality. It's very strong in his work about eternity and time, the meaningfulness, really, of eternity, not God.
Well, there's an interesting poem, I'm not going to read now, called City of God, which is partly about that. It's partly about having this devoted... potential Christian life as a priest, but he's not a priest, etc.
I think that was more that, Irish mothers would like to have a priest in the family, really. But I think he did have a very strong sense of the spiritual, I suppose, but he just didn't have a belief system. Oh, he was a lapsed or rejected Catholicism, really.
But one of the other interesting things, which I think may be worthwhile talking about more, we've already hinted at it. I think it's particularly clear to Michael, because I was... When I got this job last night, I immediately went back. Fortunately, I had Michael's collected poems with me on my Kindle, so I immediately went back to that. And of course, when I started reading from the point of view of conducting a conversation, then I noticed things more than I had, because before I was just reading poem by poem, and just reading just how many... how important the notion of identity is in Michael. I don't mean anything so deeply psychological on a personal level, but just the idea that, for example, in his later poems, he writes dramatic monologues. So he writes for other voices, clearly voices other than his. And then sometimes you think you're reading about something about him in the poem. For example, there's the allusion to the Spanish Civil War, in which an uncle in the poem... Yes,
yeah.
Is supposed to have moved over from the Republican to the Francoist side, but how much documentary truth is in any of this?
No, none. He didn't have uncles in the Spanish Civil War.
So what was the importance of this? Why raise the question?
Well, why not? People say, "Where do you get your ideas from?" And he would say, "Well, I make them up. I think of them." There is a tendency nowadays to see poetry as a confessional art, and it's always got to be about expressing your experience and your feelings, but I think for him it was not... It's not to say that he's not there. I think he's very vividly there in his work, and some of it is more... As he got older, it gets more personal in the sense of dealing with his father's death, with Rory and being a father. But you should never assume that what you're reading is a story, because he was a great storyteller too. And you think, well...
But it's interesting to think, because you mentioned the idea of confessionalism. Just your confessional poets, your Lowells, your Prath, Plath, your Berrymans.
Sharon Olds,
particularly. And one of the things Maddie was saying to me in the conversation we were having before this was that that was one of the reasons, maybe, that Michael felt less comfortable in the American poetry of the 80s, the mid-80s, because he felt that that was not what he wanted to do.
No. I think he was more interested, in philosophical issues. And that's what he was trying to express through these various personas and poems.
That's what I mean. There's a sort of great depth to this, at the bottom of this, which I feel very sympathetic to, the uncertainty. Uncertainty, not just in a personal sense of, who am I, Michael Donaghy or whatever, but in a sense uncertainty about just being anything, being anywhere. So I asked the Spanish Civil War thing because it's part of the, if you like, the questioning. How does one get to be this thing, or how does one get to be that thing? Could I possibly be that thing if I speak in that voice? Will I become that thing? And I think it's a very important element in Michael. Now I'm just thinking, why don't we do the machines thing?
Yes,
and then
okay.
We can... This is what I will read.
Yeah, hang on, I'll go up to the lectern. I'd rather read up there. Wonderful little book by Don Patterson, who sadly is only represented by a paper tonight, about Michael's poetry. It was originally called 50 Ways to Read a Poem, but the publisher insisted on changing it. So it's now called Smith. It's a reader's guide to the poetry of Michael Donaghy, and he takes 50 poems, and instead of treating them in a dull, academic, sort of vivisectional way, carving them up, Michael once said that if you went into English literature because you liked poetry, it was like going into vivisection because you liked animals. So he didn't really believe in... I mean, he believed in being able to talk about poetry, but not having to take it to pieces. And this is wonderful in a way, because it does... explain and take to pieces what Michael's trying to do, in Don's opinion. I can't say I always agree with him, but that's what poetry is about, really. It's very anecdotal, and because they were very close friends, there's a lot of personal insight into it as well. So I'd recommend it if you're interested in Michael's work. And what I'm going to do is, because Don's not here, I'm going to read Machines, which is one of Michael's early poems, and then what Don, the couple of pages that he wrote about it. And Machines, actually, Michael sent to me as a love poem. But I think it's a poem about love. I think he sent it to me because I happened to be the love interest at that moment. In fact, last year I had to read at the South Bank in a festival of love poetry. And the journalist rang me about it. And she was convinced that we spent the whole day wafting round quoting poetry to each other at home. So it wasn't like that. But anyway... it is a very beautiful poem. Oops. Keep making this gong sound here. Dearest, note how these two are alike. This harpsichord pavane by Purcell and the racer's 12-speed bike. The machinery of grace is always simple. This chrome trapezoid, one wheel connected to another of concentric gears, which Ptolemy dreamt of and Schwinn perfected, is gone. The cyclist... not the cycle, steers. And in the playing, Purcell's chords are played away. So this talk, or touch if I were there, should work its effortless gadgetry of love, like Dante's heaven, and melt into the air. If it doesn't, of course, I've fallen. So much is chance, so much agility, desire, and feverish care, as bicyclists and harpsichordists prove. Who only by moving can balance, only by balancing move. So John's heading for this is Argument. Not sure why. This is the sort of poem that won Donaghy the reputation of a modern metaphysical. There's no doubt that Donne, Marvell and Herbert were among his primary influences. That Donaghy's later poems will often conceal their sometimes complex algebraic form. I should say about Michael that he could not rub two numbers together. If things were two for the price of one, he'd buy three. So he couldn't add up, but he was very interested in geometry, shape, the spatial qualities of mathematics. Yeah. Where was I? The first line declares two things. Firstly, that this is a love poem. Secondly, that its thesis will be delivered with some authority. The mock formal didactic address is maintained throughout. The poem is about neither harpsichords nor bikes, but the love poem itself. Only we don't know that yet. The bike and the harpsichord profound aren't obviously alike at all. However, so the poem has that, oh, do go on, quality. Then we're given the solution. The machinery of grace is always simple. Except there's nothing particularly simple in either example. So the statement merely intrigues us further. This graceful, perfect machine of interconnected gears was how Ptolemy imagined the solar system to be. The idea was rubbish, alas, as Copernicus later demonstrated, but it was a lovely vision. You've seen the models of the everything going around the Earth. However, that vision was realized otherwise in the wonderful geared machine created by F.W. Schwinn, whose father, Ignaz, founded the Schwinn Bicycle Company in Chicago at the end of the 19th century. Either way, the bike is gone, the cyclist has pedaled off. That's what a good bike does, disappears. In the same way, the pattern of Purcell's Pavane, his dream machine of interconnected notes, is played out of its own existence as the harpsichordist plays away the blueprint of the written score. But there's a little more to it than that. We get to the heart of the poem with the second comparison. This very talk, this poem, this little love speech I'm giving right now, something I could translate into the sense of touch if only I was physically closer to you, works in the same way. Read it and it will do its love work and then be gone, like the nine spheres of the Paradiso wherein Dante's beloved Beatrice resides, Beatrice. The Paradiso ends with Dante figuring how these spheres all work together and concludes it's through God's love. Here power failed, this is a quote from Dante, here power failed my lofty vision, but now my desire and will were turning like a fixed wheel, rotating evenly by the love which moves the sun and the other stars. Donaghy puts it all somewhat more concisely. Behind both poems lurks the idea of musica universalis, the celestial geared wheels, Pythagorean ratios that govern the harmony of the spheres. If it doesn't, I failed as a poet. I've fallen off the bike, or I've hit the cracks, and I've proved a lousy operator of my own poem machine. I've tried, though, with all the feverish care I've put into this love speech, driven by my own desire for you. But in the end, it all comes down to this real-time performance in which movement and balance depend perfectly upon one another. If they can't, both bike and cyclist fall over, and the musician, as musicians say, falls off the chart. So, how did I do? I think he knows the answer. Since the balancing act here is the poet's elaborate comparison, is this really a love poem or just a poem about a love poem? Like many of Shakespeare's sonnets, it appears to be more about poetry than love. However, in both cases, I think love is expressed less in the content, which says very little about the beloved, than in the gift of the near-perfect poem itself, which says everything. So, you know.
There's a lovely characteristic touch of Michael's in that poem, which I think says Michael to me all over, which is where he says that line, what Ptolemy dreamt of, Schwinn perfected. And you think, who the hell is Schwinn? Yes? No. Don Patterson, I think, it's a lovely reading of that poem, actually. Where it tells you, Schwinn invented a bicycle. So you get these two names juxtaposed next to each other. So, you know, so the whole idea of Ptolemy was to get this bike at the end, yes? So there's a humour in that, there's an irony in it, but it's very gentle, it's very delicate. And these other grand names, the Ptolemies, the Purcells, the Dantes, which can sometimes seem as though they kind of dropped almost the kind of impressive set of references. Flute. I think, to sort of float rather beautifully in there. One of the things I wanted to pick up from the idea of moving from America, partly in order to avoid this overwhelming wave of later confessionalism, is Michael's own sources or Michael's own loves in poetry. And then Don Patterson has already talked about George Herbert, Don, and the metaphysicals generally. So I'm sure that's there in the way that the science interacts with emotion, interacts with the arts, and the whole thing is a kind of complete conceit, a kind of, you know, like a 17th century conceit. But there's this other side of Michael's thing, which the late, well, I suppose post-war American poetry also had, which is a much more East Coast thing, which was poets like Richard Wilbur, Anthony Hecht, James Merrill. Did you talk about them?
Robert Frost.
And Robert Frost, of course, which is who predates them all.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did he talk about them?
Yes, he did.
Oh, he knew a lot off by heart. I mean, Michael was, you know, not, he didn't only recite his own poetry by heart, he knew, had a lot of other poetry by heart because of his listening to the beauty of the sound as well. He had a room full of books, three walls of books, because he couldn't pass a bookshop without going in. And all of his books are now housed in the Arvon Foundation's, the Hearst Library, which is up in Craven Arms. Yeah. So it's not that far from here. Well, relatively speaking to London, it's not that far from here. Mm. So they've taken his library as a whole, as a support library for the writing courses that they run, which is lovely. But he had a very wide, he was very widely read, really.
That's a very interesting sort of line. I myself was very much in love with the Wilbers and the Hechts and the Merrills. But interesting that that American voice found a home here to some degree,
yeah.
And that maybe because of the metaphysicals. Were there poets in England to whom he felt, well, of any period apart from the metaphysicals, to whom he felt particularly, contemporary or just 20th century, to
well,
whom
Derek
he felt
Mahon
very close?
Derek Mahon was a very big influence.
Yeah.
Because, well, particularly the early Derek Mahon, I think, and Michael Longley to some degree, and Heaney. I mean, some of the Irish poets, but particularly the idea that you could write a quite formal poem that would have within it a very modern idea, you know. He really believed, I think, Michael, that form sets you free, that the form is important. So, you know, you can write any old words, really, but if you're constrained within a form, he didn't always write within traditional forms, but he always wrote with a structure in mind, I think, because that was what allowed him to be free within that.
Do these names have resonance for you? I mean, Wilbur and Hecht and James Merrill. I'm just thinking, if you're thinking, I mean, Derek Mahon is an obvious thing, also, you've got the Irish connection.
Yeah.
And I think maybe in England you could think of people like John Fuller, if his name is still familiar. Yes? Should be. Louis MacNeice.
Louis MacNeice, yes.
W.H. Auden, yeah. So there's that
it's
line.
Like Larkin. I've never heard Mike comment on Larkin at all.
That's a big subject. That's a very big subject.
Anyway, just to let you know, I don't think you like Larkin.
No, I think that's something to do with his spirit, isn't it? As much as because Larkin's technique would have been sort of, you know, perfectly at ease
exactly,
with him.
I don't know what the problem was with it, really.
Yeah. So if you're drawing a kind of map, I think you will see Michael is a highly civilized poet, but he's not somebody who wears that civilization like a series of medals, you know. There on his chest. They're not decorations. So it raises the interesting question as to how far modernity offers itself up to those constraints, to those forms, to that idea of grace in which, if you like, on one hand, the perfect idea of grace is something like a bicycle combined with Purcell, yes? And the whole thing then begins to live in Dante's Paradiso.
Mm.
And so people cycling around in
paradise.
He considered
it a young man's poem, he told me. So.
Yeah, it's rather lovely, though, isn't it,
I mean, yeah.
For all of that. How do you think his career as a poet developed? Because he didn't write very much. He was incredibly fastidious,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he produced a slim volume about every 7 years. Mm-hmm. And he usually, when he was writing, wrote over quite a condensed period of time, but there were lots of periods in between where he tinkered around a bit but didn't write anything particular. Yes, he was a perfectionist, I think. That's why. And it's good, because it means most of what he's left us is really, really wonderful.
Yes, a collected poems is not very big.
Not very big for a 20-year career, 30-year career.
Was he fastidious in his home life and
not
everything?
Not at all. No, I think his need for form and structure and meaning and everything else was all condensed into little blocks of 14 lines and everything else. We once had a break-in, and the police came in. Somebody threw a brick through the window into his study, and the police came in and said, "Oh, my God, what a mess." And I said, no, it's always like this. And they said, "Was anything missing?" I said, "Hard to tell, really, but..." So he was a bit chaotic in real life. He was a real artist. He lived on a higher plane, leaving the rest of us hanging on to him by the coattails. And I have a son who is rather similar.
I thought what we'd do, because we're moving towards the time, it'd leave you some time for questions. I'd read one more poem of his, The Hunter's Spurs, which is actually the first poem I ever heard Michael read. And then maybe talk a bit about that and just open it up to you. For any questions, and I hope you have some. Think about it. So this is The Hunter's Spurs, which is actually a tune, isn't it? It's an Irish tune.
It's an Irish tune. It's a horn.
Yeah. So this is Michael going back to his father's side, but also to his mother's earlier. It's part of the music of him. The Hunter's Spurs is the last unshattered 78 by patrolman Jack O'Ryan, violin, a Sligo fiddler in dry America. A legend, he played Manhattan's Kayleys, fell asleep drunk one snowy Christmas on a Central Park bench, and froze solid. They shipped his corpse home, like his records. This record's record is its lunar surface. I wouldn't risk my stylus to this gouge or this crater left by a flick of ash. When Anne Quinn got hold of it back in Kilrush, she took her fiddle to her shoulder and cranked the new Horn of Plenty Victrola over and over and over and scratched along until she had it right, or until her father shouted, "We'll have no more of that tune in this house tonight." She slipped out back and strapped the contraption to the parcel rack and rode her bike to a far field by moonlight. It skips. The penny I used for ballast slips. Orion's fiddle pops and hiccups. Back to this, back to this, back to this. A napping snowman with a fiddle case. A flask of bootleg under his belt. 3 stars. A gramophone and a pushbike. A cigarette's glow from a far field. Over and over. 3 bars. In common time. That's another relatively early poem, but a very, very beautiful thing, which I think gets to the heart of the musicality of Michael.
Yes, and I think the interesting thing about that, which I think also Don mentions in his book, is that the journey of Irish music was rather similar to that of Michael's parents, as in Ireland you have different regional styles, which are quite distinct. I mean, the basic kinds of tunes are similar, but the playing styles and even the way the rhythm is dealt with are different. But when there was mass immigration to America, of course, they took their music with them. And it got developed. It got a little bit mixed up with bluegrass music and Appalachian fiddle. It got written down for the first time. There's some stories about the police chief of Chicago who used to let suspects off if they would write down a tune for him. Only Chief O'Neill, he was a big hero of Michael's. And then it was recorded and imported back. So in the poem, she's listening to probably Michael Coleman, who was a fiddle player. So she's listening to a different style, possibly, from what she would have played in the first place. So it's very interesting, that about sort of twice emigration, really.
Would anybody like to ask anything? Does anybody have any questions?
I'd be really interested if you could say something about personal relationships, sex, things like Black Ice and Rain, Cadenza.
What do you want to know?
Don't ask me.
Black Ice and Rain was actually based on something from Michael's history, but it's changed a lot in the writing of it. It was something that happened to him that he was very, very upset about, of which the basic story is the story of the poem. And it took him 25 years or something to write it, to actually get it into a poem. So I'm not saying he never put his own life into poems, but he was very private.
Well, Sean O'Brien writes quite a lot about that in the introduction, right. That particular poem, yeah. It's recollected. Yeah.
Cadenza, is, I think, was written actually after his sister had a miscarriage, so yeah. It wasn't a personal thing at all. It was something that sort of, you know, these little threads come from somewhere and are drawn in. I mean, it's actually taken me quite a long time to actually talk about those things, because I know that he really didn't consider that important as far as reading the poem. But I think now, 10 years after he died, it's fine to spill a few beans.
Well, isn't it interesting, you know, just how one balances the documentary life with the life of the imagination, the truth of the imagination, and how far the truths of the imagination are, in fact, part of the truths of your documentary life, and that they become, you speak them, that you sort of find them, don't you?
And it seems to me one of the things he does best is to convince me as a reader that this is happening.
Right.
I actually mind whether it really happened or not, but it's one of the qualities of his poem.
Yes.
That it really puts you in that situation.
And you know what the key poem is in there? It's the poem called Pornography, which is about buying your sympathy with a really good story. Yeah. I mean, he was Irish as well. I mean, the Irish have a long history of telling tales. But yes, that's what he wanted. He wanted to convince. And actually, he'll convince you of things that can't possibly be true. You know.
One of the other nice things that Sean says in his introduction is that how far Michael's poems address specific listeners. I don't mean specific in real documentary life, but there's a sense that the voice that is talking is not just talking out there, but is in the middle of conversation, and you're kind of catching him as he's telling his story. And Sean's question, which is a very interesting one, is how far are we engaged with a speaker? And how far do we identify with a speaker? Or how far do we identify with a situation? And when a speaker, because you know what happens in this poem, that there's this potential sort of threesome, there's this couple who the central speaker meets, and it has promise of something. Probably nothing really comes of it. And later there's a car crash which kills the man. Mm. And then he meets the woman who is kind of disfigured by the crash. Yeah. And then they kind of get it on. But then he leaves. And then, so you're left suspended, aren't you, with that sense that it's, if it's a personality, it's one that is deeply unresolved.
I don't know if has anyone here, did you come to a reading that he gave ever? And it was like having the poem spoken in your ear, very intimately, I thought. He spoke very much to the individual. And I just wanted to say something about him memorising the poems. It happened by accident. He was in a theatre giving a reading, and there was a power cut. And he found that actually he knew them anyway, so he just carried on giving the reading by heart. And it was so much better that he then decided, well, you know, if people can memorise an entire Shakespeare play, I can certainly learn a few poems that I wrote, you know. So
there's a question there.
Yeah, holding on from that, did he enjoy the performance? Did he enjoy going out and reading his work to the audience?
Oh, I think so.
He felt he had to do.
He didn't like travelling, so the getting to and from was always a big stress, but I think he really loved engaging with people, actually. In fact, I went to the Dickens Museum a few years ago, and I remember thinking, well, this is a bit like Michael. He had this writing career, and then he had this performing career, and I think Michael's performing career was quite important, actually. And he was well known for doing it well, and, of course, he also did teaching and did that very well in his own way.
Question there.
Yeah, I was
question over there somewhere?
Not a question, I just wanted to say that you should both delight for the house guests.
Oh, did he stay with you?
Stay with us on 30 visits.
Oh.
He wasn't food at home, he was just... he was very, very good company.
He was genius. He used to dream things like the Book of Revelations. I don't know if that's been brought up a Catholic, but his nightmares always had four-headed creatures in them. I think that. Oh, was it? It was just general untidiness, probably. But. That thing of being there and not there is very, very familiar to me. And my son's like that too. And to be honest, I'm a bit like it too, so we obviously all a rich inner life, I think of it as.
Anything else? Anybody else?
Would you like to say something about Michael's process in developing the poem and how much of that he shared with you in the time that he developed them?
He used to write on big graph paper, sort of plot it out in a sort of diagrammatic way. Yeah. I usually read the first... He would read the first draft to me. I think he... Not to say, is this any good, but is there anything that's really not clear in it? But I wouldn't know that I had any influence on whether it was changed or not, but I would read a first draft.
Did he share with with friends? Did he show?
Well, he took it to workshops sometimes, but I don't think... John says he didn't ever change a dot or an at or anything. You know, he just... he'd take it to the workshop and people would say, well, that's great. And then at workshops people would say, but maybe you could, you know. And he's like, thanks. I think he was pretty confident about his powers as a poet, and justly so.
There's a question there.
Did he have many writer's blocks that he could get? Could he cope with them, or...?
I suppose he would say he probably spent most of his life in writer's block. He only wrote in quite sort of intensive... He didn't write on a sort of steady basis at all.
But he didn't set himself a time shift?
No. When there was a book to be written, then he would work very... just constantly on it, really. I mean, it's the difficulty also of being a writer and teaching and being asked to write reviews, and there's a lot of demands on your attention. And he wasn't particularly good at organising that time. But I think once he got an idea, then he would just go for it, really. But it had to be the right idea and work in the right way for him.
When you say the sort of multi side of him, what were his other main interests outside of writing poetry? Because he loved art, didn't he?
Well, music. Music was big. And
was he a sportsman? Did he go to...
He ran every day, but that was for health and sanity, not for... he wasn't a team sports... No, and he wasn't remotely interested in football or anything like that. So. But he was very interested in just the world and
politics, news,
culture. Not politics as we think of it. No, not interested in party politics.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Would you like me to say the present? Because that's a part
of it. Of course,
I can say it off by heart.
Please do.
That's the only one I know.
Yes.
For the present, there is just one moon, though every level pond gives back another. But the bright disk shining in the black lagoon, perceived by astrophysicist and lover, is milliseconds old, and even that light 7 seconds older than its source. And the light we think we see on moonless nights is long extinguished. And of course, this very moment as you read this line is literally gone before you know it. Forget the here and now, we have no time, but this device of wantonness and wit. Make me this present then, your hand in mine, and we'll live out our lives in it.